You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nikita.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I am doing okay. I'm trying to catch up.
Aren't
I'm excited
we all,
about, I've been telling you about Cloud Code. I'm excited about the opportunities that it offers to me, but I'm frustrated by the lack of time in the day to follow every rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's the ratio of rabbit holes to time is my life story. It's a problem. It's thwarted me in so many ways. So let me introduce. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero podcast. You are Nikita Petrov, a member of Team Non-Zero and also the proprietor of the Psychopolitica newsletter. And we're going to talk again. We talked a couple weeks ago, and you laid this grand unified theory of MAGA on me. And I'm happy to report that your theory has apparently expanded. I don't grasp all the contours yet, but you can explain that to us. I gather it is now it now encompasses deep metaphysical questions about human agency. It now encompasses AI. And so by the end of this conversation, pretty much everything should be explained if your theory is valid. On the other hand, as you know, Nikita, sometimes theories aren't. And it'll be my job to test your theory and give you pushback and ask penetrating questions. So I guess where do we leave off about MAGA? I think... we said that MAGA is MAGA, and I think you laid out the kind of standard MAGA narrative, right, about and elaborated on how it all fits together. What would you say about the state of play at the end of our last conversation?
So my pitch that time was that the domestic and the foreign policy of the Trump administration match. They make sense together because they didn't previously. I couldn't put them all together. And then my insight was that it all makes sense because what it's all about is about reclaiming the agency at the level of a people, a nation. And so domestically, you need to clarify what that people is. So mass deportations, because this is not part of our nation, and consolidating power at the federal level so that it is more of a whole coherent thing. We're all moving in the same direction. And this break-in or attempts to kind of shake these international organizations and the quote-unquote rule-based order is, you know, for your, since you're fighting against this globalized world to make America the nation, the sort of nation state, the agentic force, you want other nations to play along with you. You don't want this universal place, UN or something that makes decisions. You want individual nations to compete with, fight against, do business with. And so a victory of a nationalist populist kind of movement in any one country that tries to establish this sovereignty, this agentic sense of their nation is a benefit to you because it's all the part of the same project, a kind of nationalist revolution globally. That was my take there.
And I think I said I kind of do, on the one hand, see things fitting together much as you do. I would draw the arrows of causality maybe differently, or maybe it's just like the origin point of my thinking about it is different. I mean, I guess, thinking about it now, I guess you could view politics as, you know, an attempt to a large extent of politicians who themselves are vying for power and influence and, specific like seats in Congress that there's only one of when there are multiple candidates for them. And doing this vying by, you know, very often in one sense or another, appealing to people's tribal impulses in the sense of wanting them to join your tribe, at least in that minimal sense, which often involves demonizing other tribes very loosely, just groups of people, right? Like you often want them to find some other group as threatening, like in American politics right now, Trump wants you to find immigrants, low-wage workers in China as threatening, or in China, he might cast it slightly differently rhetorically. Whereas people in Team Blue, they want you to find Trump and Trumpists as threatening. And, you know, I personally think they are, but that's, I'm on Team Blue. I would, wouldn't I? And, you know, one of the plays has been since the tremors from globalization started becoming evident kind of in the 90s in a way, or if not late 80s, one of the plays has been, it's these global elites who sold your job to mm-hmm. low-wage labor, did something, these nefarious elites. So there's been this nationalist strain for a long time. And, you know, a lot of the tremors from globalization have gotten bigger. Some of them are actually from automation, interestingly. In that sense, the roots of what AI is going to do to further destabilize the system go back further than you might realize, precisely because it's been the interests of a lot of politicians really to kind of obscure the role of automation in threatening American manufacturing jobs and historically, and put the blame more on individuals, immigrants, low-wage workers, and so on. So that's kind of an alternative way of looking at a movement that demonizes, first of all, a certain number of other nations, but also like global institutions, World Trade Organization, even UN. It's funny, Peter Thiel's gotten some publicity fairly recently for talking about world government as the Antichrist. That goes right back like decades. They were saying the same thing in the 90s. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Who's the guy who had the show? Oh, Pat Robertson, who had the 500 Club or whatever it was on this Christian network. That was then. So yeah, this was kind of the state of play as of last time, although I think I put my side of it a little differently in some ways than I did last time. And I think you did too. But anyway, in thinking about it since then, you have thought more about issues of agency and more about AI. And I certainly think those two are connected, because AI is going to question human agency in new ways that will feed into this, all of this, one way or another.
Right. So where we left last time was my entry point into a kind of new train of thought. So I kept thinking about MAGA and what drives it. And here's a kind of a different angle on it. So last time you questioned my theory by saying, I'm making it sound like this narrative about the global elites and all of that is causal, while there are also material circumstances, like people are struggling mm-hmm. for jobs and whatnot. And mm-hmm. I don't disagree with you. I kind of feel that the narrative is what emerges over time when you see different vectors in the political reality, you know, the sum of them point into some direction. So there's a movement. There are like politicians looking out for their own interests and voters voting for different reasons. Mm-hmm. For some, it's economics, for some, it's cultural. But once there, a lot of them are pointed in the same directions and they're moving the country in a direction, if a shared narrative for all of them emerges, if a story that makes sense to all of them on different level emerges, then that can be clarifying for me, at least, to like make sense of like what this mm-hmm. thing even is. But a different way to describe that same movement to me is it's a response to a felt lack of agency. And that can be on an individual kind of ground, down to earth level. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have enough money. The bills are too high. I don't feel agency in that sense. Like I just don't mm-hmm. have the opportunities that I used to have. People used to be able to buy houses and now they can't. And then on a cultural level, you know, it used to be men are men and women are women. And now it's all different and I don't understand it. And I didn't choose it. I don't know who did. Like, all of my neighbors are confused by this as well. So if we didn't choose it, who did? And how do we regain that sense of agency? And this is kind of a psychological, I guess, take, where it's like, if you don't feel that agency in your life, one way to regain it is to join with others and try to gain collective agency, or a sense of it at least. Like, making America great again. We'll come together, we'll have a movement, our representative is going to be in a seat of power, and we as a nation will feel like America is choosing its own path. It doesn't have to abide by these international laws on the foreign policy front. At home, there's this purging of immigrants. So it feels like, let's bring it back to a more homogeneous America that you might remember or feel like you remember. And that's where why I started thinking about agency. And then I don't connect AI directly. So it's connected to everything, I feel like, AI. But it's like agency becomes the central point of my thinking here. And then, you know, if MAGA is a response on the part of, you know, Donald Trump voting Americans to this sense of a lack of agency, they're not the only ones who feel that. You know, in my country, when my country invaded Ukraine, I didn't feel like I had agency in that. And all of us are going to start feeling, I think, a lot of this lack of agency because of AI as well. Just the world is going to be changing even faster than it has been. And how you navigate a world that changes so fast will determine whether you feel like you have agency because of this wave of change, like you're riding the wave, or you're going to feel like you're being crushed by the wave. And then feel a lack of agency, which will have to lead you someplace psychologically. You will gravitate towards responses to that. How do you, what would give you a more of a sense of agency if you don't actually have it?
Yeah. And there's two kind of different connections of AI to agency. I mean, on the one hand, as you said, it's gonna change and disturb things in ways that make people grasp for ways to regain control. Any technology can, in principle, do that. The Industrial Revolution kind of did that. And you saw workers looking for ways to regain agency. And some of them joined like Marxist causes. This is the way we're going to hang on to our bargaining power and keep wages high and so on. So, joining a tribe is a common way to regain that kind of agency. But separate from that, AI, you know, it's funny. In the last issue of the Non-Zero newsletter, which was... the title was "The AI Trimmers Are Real," and I said there was a line where I said I talked about agentic AI, and then the moment came when I was going to use it as a noun, and I said agenthood, and then in parentheses I said note that I didn't say agency because this isn't the place for a big metaphysical discussion, but AI does raise the question of agency at that level. And that is going to be the more deeply threatening. Well, I don't know which people will find more viscerally threatening, but there's a sense in which this is more profound. This is the first technology which really we're going to be transferring some agency to in a meaningful sense. Now, whether that's the deep metaphysical sense. I mean, at the deepest metaphysical level, some people equate agency with like free will. And, you know, people disagree. Do we have free will? If we do, will machines have it? I don't know. To me, free will is a classic imponderable question. Like, I don't purport to have the answer. But I will say that if you look at all of the things that people do, which we sometimes attribute to free will, people do use the term free will, attribute to free will, it's not clear that any of those things are things that AI won't be able to do. It's not clear. I'm not saying they will be able to, but I'm saying it's not clear that they won't. So
what kinds of things do you have in mind?
Well, name a thing. What's the most impressive thing? I mean, be CEO of a company, that kind of thing. Okay.
Right.
There are smart people in AI. In fact, maybe most. Like, I would bet you that if you got, I don't know what they publicly said, but the head of Anthropic and Google DeepMind and OpenAI, although Altman is different from the other two in the sense that they are AI tech guys, researchers, and he is like a founder who's conversant in tech. But anyway, I'll bet they would all three say, yeah, I think that's coming. I think you can have AIs that are CEOs, okay? Well, okay, then what manifestation of free will can't? If they can do that, what manifestation of free will can't AI do? You tell me. And I'm not saying they will be able to be CEOs, but I will say one thing. You know, CEOs are going to become more and more dependent on them. And it's not just for clerical work, but to inform very big strategic decisions. And at some point, the distinction between informing a strategic decision and making the decision begins to blur if the person has enough trust in the machine.
Yeah. I've been sort of less thinking, I think, and more feeling about this kind of, you know, having a process in it, because I've been playing, as you know, with Claude Code. And I think it's a transformative technology. And I'm re-envisioning all of the different things that I do, all of the different creative projects, work projects, like where is the place for AI there? And whatever I'm thinking about it now is going to change half a year down the road as the technology gets better and I get better at using it. But it's already so... like it's a tool for everything. There's not like one specific use case, and it's you figuring out what to use it for and how you want to use it. And the question of what do you still want to do yourself and what are you okay outsourcing to the machine is kind of central. And if the machine can do all of these different things, what do you want to do? Like you know, when I see artists complain, like, I mean, visual, you know, illustrators who are, as a tribe, generally speaking, are very anti-AI, partly because it threatens them economically. Like, there's a person's job, and AI can make illustrations now. I kind of feel like it doesn't resonate with me, because I feel if we're talking about art as, and it's often coded, their critiques, in this like high-minded rhetoric about art. It's, you know, the purpose is human expression and whatnot. And I feel like that is not being taken away from you. If you want to draw, to express yourself, you can still do that. Where you're being threatened is selling that for money. And there, I'm kind of in the place of somebody, like, I would love to pay artists to make art that I like, but that's very expensive, and AI can do a pretty good job, and then I can be creative by telling it what to draw and figuring out how to use the drawings it makes in, you know, a bigger project. And so I don't feel like my creativity is being threatened here, because I get to use cheaper robotic tools for things that they're pretty good at. But the question of like where your creativity still has space that you feel good about, and when do you feel it's slipping away? Where do you yourself draw the lines and what you want the machines to do so that you still have things to do that you feel good about? It's central to all of these tools, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think you're right, and it's interesting. And by the way, I think this is the, you know, Dario Amodei, who head of Anthropic, who recently came out with an essay about the downside and risks of AI, which I haven't really processed yet. I'll eventually say something about it. But his earlier essay, now nearly a year and a half old, was about if everything goes right. It was called Machines of Loving Grace. And and he was saying, you know, kind of what you're saying, like, look, everything we get gratification out of in the workplace, he was like, okay, maybe, you know, who knows what'll happen with jobs, but everything you get gratification out of, you can still do. You can work in teams toward a goal. He didn't elaborate really. I mean, I guess you would imagine some kind of gamified virtual reality situation, maybe, or whatever. But in that case, he's like, in the real world, I go, you know, I like hiking. I like this. You can do creative writing. So that's all true. But of course, there is the side of the argument that, okay, but historically, what people do when they don't have to, in order to make a living, go work in teams and stuff, is they do a variety of things, including sit on a couch and inject heroin. You know, it's just not guaranteed that everyone will respond in a healthy fashion to this. There's that. There's so much here because, but one thing I want to quickly add to get back to MAGA is one very interesting dynamic is if you ask, okay, so what groups are going to feel what kinds of losses of agency as a result of AI?
Mm-hmm.
In any sense of the term agency that we've used, including just, wait a second, how do I get control of my life again because I no longer have it along this one dimension? On the job front, on that manifestation of loss of control, you know, AI is interesting because whereas the victims of automation as of 10, 20, 30 years ago were largely people who are the kinds of people who you now associate with the Trump constituency, that is to say manual laborers, factory workers, okay? They were being victimized by automation, among other things. This is, of course, gonna hit white-collar workers more, and it's unclear how much. I don't know, but at a minimum, it's going to require some of them to get new job skills, even assuming they can find the work. And a lot of these people are not currently in the Trump constituency. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. So, you know, that part of the reaction against AI may hit the blue tribe more. At the same time, just the general disturbance, you would expect to activate certain kinds of conservative impulses, you know, classically known as Burkean, after Edward mm-hmm. Burke conservatism, where you just don't like things to change too fast. I mean, tradition gets upset, norms start changing fast. That can make a lot of people uncomfortable, but as classically associated with a kind of conservatism, you know, the reaction against that is. So I don't think I've said anything except that this is going to get messy, but there's so many ways this is going to get messy. I don't know.
I have a couple of reactions. One is to your point about people sitting on the couch and doing heroin. So we're in Spain here, and it's been 2 years. I'm still kind of just like looking around, trying to figure out what is going on here. But so I don't claim expertise or real cultural understanding of the place I'm at. But one thing that happens, from my understanding, everywhere you go in Spain, that it changes what rituals they do, what kind of traditions, but there's always a thing to do. So here in Malaga, in Andalusia, we're right now in the period of Carnaval. It's a week of dances and dress up and music and this and that. And then soon after, there's going to be Easter, which is a whole week of carrying huge statues of Jesus and Virgin Mary and wearing hoods and orchestras playing and candles are being lit and services are being done. And then in August, there's going to be La Feria, which is mostly just dancing and drinking and music. And then the Christmas, and there's this rhythm to life. And these are big ones. And then in between, there are a lot of small ones. And it feels like generally what the culture is about is we're going to get together and do something together. And it could be just getting out for drinks and food and chatting, or it could be, you know, this Holy Week, the Semana Santa with the statues. This is a hard work, from what I understand. He's a pretty heavy Jesus that they're carrying around. And we were, Karine and I, my wife and I, were sitting at a cafe looking at this Carnaval thing happening. There's so much preparation that goes into it. Families, groups of people, dressed up, choreographed dances. And she said, like, these people are not going to be, they might be the only ones who survive this AI revolution without much of a hiccup, because it's so rooted in the culture that we're going to get outside with other people and find something to do, and we're going to extract meaning from that interaction. So the point from this maybe is going to be culturally dependent. I mean, if your society is already struggling with isolation, you know, like in Japan, they have these hikikomori. It's like a whole word for a large group of people who just stay inside and never leave their apartment. That is going to be, I mean, with AI, it's going to be on steroids, and it's going to, there will be more and more opportunities of this. So I wonder how now, it's going to hit differently in different places.
Yeah, by the way, my friend Bruce Feiler has a very relevant book coming out in May called A Time to Gather, How Ritual Created the World and How It Can Save Us. And, you know, that's part of what you're talking about there is you know, group rituals involving human contact in physical space have been a big part of life. It sounds like they've been a bigger part of it in Spain than in the U.S. You know, the U.S., it's not that ritually oriented in a certain sense. I mean, or maybe it's just different rituals, different traditions. But it is, you know, this is a tangent, but, you know, I grew up Southern Baptist, and I think we were almost determinedly anti-ritual. Like one of the ways, this was back when intra-Christian rivalry was a bigger thing. I mean, these days, like, any Christian, Catholic, Protestant is just kind of happy to find another one in America, right? Because it's a more besieged worldview. But in those days when Baptists would badmouth Catholics, they would say, for them, it's all about ritual. For us, it's about belief. And and Baptists just weren't very high ritual, you know? And I do think that is it's certainly not the only strain of Protestantism, and, you know, Episcopalianism is more ritualistic probably, but I do think that represents a strain of American culture that was here kind of early, maybe if only because America was from the beginning, more than people realize, I think it was an amalgam of different cultures, even fairly early on. You know, you had Catholics, Protestants, and so maybe that's why. But anyway, that tangent aside, I do think AI is going to increase the perceived value of getting together with people. It may not always be in physical space, but if you're even on at a book club that's being done on Zoom, and you're sure all the people are real people, that will distinguish that space from some other spaces that you can stumble into. And I think that kind of thing will be more valuable.
Sorry,
go ahead. No, go ahead. I'll talk about this later.
I was about to say that that's where I feel being pulled in the direction. And it's not just like it's Zoom. It's also like I do write and draw and stuff. I haven't been publishing a whole lot lately. And part of the reason I think I haven't been publishing is I've been doing this on Substack, and Substack has become crowded even before the proliferation of chatbots, LLMs that will write your posts for you. Now it's just, you don't know what's written by a human, what's written by a bot, and you kind of feel, mm-hmm. should I be paying attention to what I'm being bombarded with here? And now, since I've been playing with Cloud Code, which allows you to, you know, it's easier to build a website, it's now interesting for me to think of new genres to invent. Like, I can build a thing online. It doesn't have to be just a blog. It doesn't have to be a, you know, sequential list of written materials. I can make something interactive. I can invent a new genre for a multimedia project online where my writing and drawings will be a part of it, but not the whole thing. And I feel like that suddenly I feel inspired by and more excited about, and partly because I would then be doing something different from this just feed of written materials on Substack that is just overflowing. Everybody has a take, everybody has a new summary, here's a new article for you to read. And I kind of think about this as I'm trying to think about sort of my strategy for Psychopolitica. Where I'm at the moment is I feel like Substack and these other places, social media places, you know, things, there is a phrase that I don't know if people use it now, but there was a time they called Twitter the town square. Like, this is the public square. And I kind of feel, okay, mm-hmm. if that is a public square, like, think of Times Square. I don't want to hang out there. Like, that's not where I spend the majority of my time. If I go meet people, I want to go to a bar I like, right? Or invite people over or go to somebody else's place. And so I think maybe the way I'll be treating Substack, you know, 3 months down the road is a high traffic street where my bot hands out flyers for people to go join my Zoom room or go to my website, which is a very different more interactive, cooler, more original environment. And I kind of feel maybe the internet will become that. Like, all of these shared places, quote unquote, these social media places, will be mostly bots handing out invitations to go join your church or your club or your reading club or whatever it is that you actually want to be doing, with a smaller group of people whose faces you hopefully see or at least hear their voices or have some other way to both make sure it's a human, but also just to feel a more of a quality connection. Instead of likes and shares and comments, you would look for a way to interact that feels more like real life interaction.
That's funny. The image that came to mind when you said that is there are places like, for example, maybe Bourbon Street in New Orleans. I don't know. It's been a long time since I've been there. But you walk down the sidewalk and like at each establishment, there's someone out there trying to draw you into the establishment.
Right.
You know, like with varying pitches appealing to various parts of human nature. Bourbon Street. And, you know, in a way, you're saying the internet will be the street, maybe, and the pitchmen or the people out there trying to draw you in will be bots, and then you'll be inside saying, "Welcome to my parlor. I am Nikita. How can I gratify you?" Is that what you'll say? How can I gratify you?
That's the model. I think I think this is what I'm thinking about at the moment. I mean, it is changing so quickly. And the reason I'm thinking about it is this Claude Code thing, which gives anybody a way to build your little establishment if you want to.
Yeah. On the Substack issue, it sounds like you're attributing things to AI that I'm not sure attributable to AI. I mean, a lot has happened at Substack. First of all, there's been more and more newsletters, and a problem we face as a newsletter at Non-Zero is that more and more of our subscribers are subscribing to other newsletters. And so, you know, I do think every honest newsletter and Substack has to reckon with the fact that probably level of engagement with your newsletter per user has declined as the number of newsletters in the world has grown. And then there are also changes in what Substack does to promote the newsletters. You know, Substack Notes has become more of a thing. And depending on how you have your notification set from Substack, you know, what emails you have and haven't unsubscribed to, you may get notified of more stuff happening on Substack, partly just by virtue of changes in what Substack is doing to promote newsletters. I don't know, but I mean, there are some realms in which I feel confident I see the work of bots, like in my Twitter notifications, even though there it's not easy. It's becoming harder in a way because they're saying super smart things and well-informed things and things that make it sound like they listen to my whole podcast, whereas in fact, they may have just scanned the YouTube transcript in a nanosecond. But in the realm of Substack, I guess maybe I just don't read other newsletters enough to be, you know, sussing out like what is and isn't bot written. But you feel confident you see an impact?
You're right that that feeling that I was describing started before the proliferation of bots, and it's just the place became more crowded because it became more successful. More people knew about it. More people showed up. But add to it the bot situation. And there is this, like, Notes has become this kind of public square of Substack where a lot of action has moved. And there, I'm sure there are a ton of bots. But even the tricky thing is, even if I don't know for sure that what I'm reading is written by a bot, if it feels like it, then I still don't want to hang out at that place. Like, it's kind of like, I remember I had this particular experience, this moment of reading somebody's comment and pausing to think whether it's AI and not concluding one way or another, but being depressed by both possibilities. Whether if it's a bot, it's said because the place is being crowded by these bots. And if it's a human who I can't distinguish from a bot, it's just like the writing is so formulaic and the thoughts are the same that I've seen yesterday and the day before and the day before. It just, why am I here? If I can't tell whether you're a real person or a machine trying to, you know, engage me, it just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel good.
Right.
So, So I don't know where that, I just feel that there's a lot of questions that are being posed, I think, by this. And in answering those questions is where my interest lays. Like, what do I want to do with both me, like, spending my time as a consumer of things online and as a creator? And so far, the kind of pull that I feel is just away from passive consumption, and the things I create, I also want to do something to them so that they feel more interactive and different from everything else, and something that the quote unquote consumer would play with more than just read and hear. You know, I want to do call-ins. I want to do Zoom group calls, writing and drawing. I want it to be clickable, and it's like I build a little toy out of the articles that I've written instead of just like a feed of stuff that goes out, to have that sense of a connection more pronounced.
And, you know, it could be, and by the way, we should probably go into overtime before long, but it could be that, you know, there will be this kind of healthy side of this, that there will be a kind of pluralization of certain kinds of creativity. I mean, the analogy I have in mind is, you know, during the heyday of like the record companies, like big record companies, big contracts, big rock groups, I would guess that a very large portion of the time that the average person spent listening to live music was in the presence of thousands of people and listening to a famous like rock group. And then when that model became threatened, I think you saw, you know, I think for a while, in a way, it became live music, at least, became less of a winner take all market. I think, I don't know. I'd have to look at that. But like, there, you know, there were all these groups that didn't have a following big enough. They didn't have like a Rolling Stones level following, but they would show up and a few hundred people would gather or something, you know. I don't know. You can imagine that. You can hope for it, I guess. But we probably should head it over time, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. Maybe I should also mention a couple of, if people have enjoyed this, some other podcasts I've done on the Non-Zero feed lately about AI. Were just did one with Tim Lee of the Understanding AI newsletter about how fast things are accelerating in AI. He's more skeptical than I am. And then before that, a conversation with Emily Bender and Alex Hanna. Emily is a founder or coiner of the term stochastic parrots as a term for large language models, whose value I questioned. I've questioned the value of the term, not the models. She questioned the value of the models. And then finally, I don't know, Nikita, you advised me. How should I handle the plugging of my book? It's still, the publication of the hardcover is still 4 months away. It's on AI.
People can pre-order it, can they?
They can. And I'm hoping to convince the publisher to get the Kindle out sooner, but I am almost certain to fail. The publishing industry is famously resistant to change.
I think we should add links to the pre-order page right to the description of this video and the show notes on the podcast feed.
You are the marketing guru I'm waiting for.
Up here in this moment in the podcast.
Yeah. Anyway, I promise not to mention it on every podcast. Only the podcasts I participate in personally. No, not even all of those. So anyway, if you've followed us this far, thank you. Consider becoming any kind of subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter if you're not one, but also the kind that would give you access to the overtime section, because that, you know, we are heading into Nikita's parlor, the aforementioned place where Nikita says, "How can I gratify you?" And it just gets... it gets almost too wild for us to talk about in this portion of the podcast, so we won't go there now, but we will. So thanks, everybody, and we're heading into overtime.